It's wabbit season.
Duck season.
Wabbit season.
Duck season.
Wabbit season.
Duck season.
Wabbit season.
Wabbit season.
I'll settle this right now. It's duck season. It's also rabbit season because it's always rabbit season, but right now is the height of duck season and pheasant and quail, and for the purposes of Thanksgiving, we should probably note it's turkey season. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're starting today's homage to the fowl less eaten with a visit to a Kansas City restaurant that really knows duck. Let's hop on over to a cozy little spot in East Brookside with intern Noah Taborda.
Charles DeBlong says the secret to cooking duck isn't the quality of the bird.
There is no real bad duck, but there is really good duck.
The secret is the preparation. Charles is the chef and owner of Brookside Poultry Company. The restaurant is closed Mondays. That's when Charles mixes a brine for all the rotisserie poultry he'll serve this week. The ducks he serves will soak in a wet brine for 72 hours. Charles' brine requires a mixture with a lot of each ingredient.
This is gonna make almost 2 gallons of brine. That's a cup and a half. Serious amount of kosher salt. I've got 4 cups of sugar. I've got 1/4 cup of black pepper ground. I've got 1/2 cup each of lemon juice, orange juice, and lime juice.
Charles admits the recipe may seem like it calls for too much of each ingredient, but he says the taste of the brine itself shouldn't be all that good.
You see a lot of brine recipes that you can taste and you're like, oh, that tastes nice. It can taste a little sugar, a little salt. Well, that's wrong.
The brine should taste too salty and too sweet, Charles says. Soaking a large amount of ducks will reduce the intense flavor of the brine as it spreads throughout the bird.
Sugar, the essence of the lime, the lemon, the orange, all that stuff, it's going to absorb that stuff. So basically, it's going to equalize through your brine, everything. So this brine is going to become much less salty, much less sweet as it goes.
Once those ingredients are mixed up, he adds some room temperature water to finish up the brine. Now the process is about patience. Grab a couple ducks, pour this mixture over top, and let it sit for the next 3 days. Once the duck has been wet brined, Charles moves the bird over to an oven where it will cook for about 4 hours, longer than the average duck. Charles does have one secret step he adds at the end, dunking the duck in a fryer for a second or two.
What that does is just tighten that skin up and get it really good and crispy, really, really thin, just paper thin. It's just fantastic.
After that, it's ready to serve. It's a simple process and even simpler served. The duck is split in half and placed skin side up on the plate. It also comes with a big box of gloves for eating utensil-free.
It's supposed to be kind of a fun way to eat it, but also it's not so messy then, because it is fall off the bone tender. You just kind of pull it off the bones and pull the skin off, and it's just a fun way to eat it.
The simplicity of the presentation reflects the restaurant's vibe. When Charles opened Brookside Poultry, he wanted it to have a relaxed, family-friendly attitude. It's an intimate space with glass figures, pictures, and artwork of chicken and ducks around the dining area. All the tables are bare wood, and there's a bar area that sits about 10. Charles says he's trying to make it feel relaxed.
It's always going to be based around families and coming in and eating with your family, just, you know, not worrying about the noise, not worrying about if your kid's crying or not. We don't care. It's all about them.
Everything on the menu is simple or familiar to the cooks as well. Even the duck is simple. Just like the atmosphere in the restaurant, Charles says just putting more focus on simple recipes can go a long way.
That's the big thing, is taking those simple things and putting some technique to them and making them right.
That was Charles DeBlong at Brookside Poultry Company talking to KCUR's Noah Taborda about duck. And now we're in the studio with someone who knows a lot about the wild fowl of Kansas and especially Missouri, James Worley. He's an outdoorsman, a conservationist, an educator, and a self-described tomato whisperer. James, good morning. Thanks
good morning.
For being here.
Thank you.
So anything you want to add about what we just heard about duck? You consider duck to be the most special fowl.
Absolutely. And ducks are special because they've evolved to migrate, to fly long distances. whereas chickens and quail and pheasant and turkeys just kind of walk around a little bit. So their muscle structure is a lot different. It's very blood rich. It's dark meat. It's very similar to beef. I like to refer to ducks as beef that flies. And it should be treated that way. You shouldn't
so
treat
the
a duck,
other dark meat.
The other dark meat. I mean, but it's dark like a steak. Duck breast is very similar to a steak. Duck legs and thighs are very similar to roast. And the stock that you make from ducks is very similar to beef stock. So when you think duck, don't think chicken, think cow.
This is, I understand, an especially good year for duck hunters.
It is and it isn't. Their duck numbers are very high, but we've had some unprecedented flooding. So the habitat along the river, Missouri River, which they migrate down, is not very good. Not a lot of plants because of the flood all year. And we had that brutal cold spell last week. And so all the ducks migrated at once. And so a lot of them, about half of them, have already passed Missouri and headed south to warmer climes. But we still have a few birds here, and I'm going to be out there Sunday and try to get myself a Thanksgiving duck dinner.
We're going to talk about that in a little bit. For people who hunt, I do understand that this is an active time of year when mm-hmm. it comes to birds more generally. What's out there in our area?
The majority of birds that we have, ducks in Missouri, are mallards. But there's lots of other ducks. We have gadwalls and teal and pintail. And of course, their bigger cousin, the goose, Canada geese and snow geese and white-fronted geese, which are kind of like ducks, but a little bigger. But it's definitely duck season, and the ducks are here. And if you're a duck hunter, hopefully you're thinking about going out this weekend.
What about pheasant and quail?
Pheasant numbers in Missouri are fairly low. Most of the birds are in the northern tier of counties in Missouri, and they're not real common. You really need to go to South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa to find larger numbers. Quail numbers are actually coming back a little bit, and it is quail season and pheasant season. West Central Missouri has quite a few quail. But not a lot of people hunt them as they did back in the day. And quail are kind of small. They're tasty little morsels, and they're really fast and hard to hunt. But it takes a really good dog to find the quail. But if you can get some, they're pretty tasty.
What about, so you have mentioned goose.
Yes.
And I have never eaten goose, though I have seen goose eggs, and they intrigue me.
Goose eggs are huge. Not as big as ostriches, but they're pretty big.
They're giant, yeah.
But goose is, like I say, a larger cousin to ducks, and has the same quality of duck meat, but tends to be a little fattier. So the skin on goose, like they talked about in your little clip there, duck skin is like bacon. Goose skin, not so much. It's a little thicker, a little rubberier, doesn't get that bacon quality. So I tend to skin my geese, and I like to pluck my ducks. So
skin a goose, pluck a duck.
There you go. Take notes on that. Right?
I feel like that's an easy little phrase to remember if you need it. With Thanksgiving on the way, mm-hmm. we do need to talk about turkey. Have you ever caught a wild turkey?
I actually shot a turkey a couple weeks ago with my crossbow. We have a pretty long archery season for turkey in Missouri. Starts in the middle of September and goes to the middle of January.
And hold up. Is archery the preferred method of turkey hunting?
Actually, the preferred season is in April, in May, for in the breeding season, where you hunt the big gobblers. And that's usually done with a shotgun. But a lot of people use archery equipment as well. But the fall season, there's a shotgun season in October, and then the archery season lasts throughout most of the fall and into the winter. But wild turkey, again, is very different than tame turkey. Very little fat. And the skin, again, is kind of tough like a goose, so I tend to skin my turkeys. But I shot a young hen, and we made pounded out the breasts and breaded them with a little egg wash and flour and made some garlic mashed potatoes and gravy and had chicken fried turkey, so it was pretty tasty.
Any tips on making turkey for our listeners? And I guess we need to make the distinction between tame turkey and wild turkey.
Turkey, to me, is probably the most overrated bird of them all.
Oh, come on.
No, it's... We think a turkey is delicious, but you need cranberry sauce, you need gravy, you need all those things. It's
You've never
side.
Had my mom's turkey.
I like dark meat turkey. I like thigh meat turkey. But turkey needs some help. It really
Try
does.
Try a kosher turkey, man.
A
I'm
kosher
serious,
turkey?
Yeah.
Okay. Take your word on it. But I'd rather have a good ham or a duck than a turkey. Just not my favorite thing.
Okay, that's fair.
Okay.
I have heard a rumor that you are making duck for Thanksgiving. You confirmed it earlier in this interview. Explain yourself.
Well, my Thanksgiving dinner is still flying around out there somewhere else. So Sunday, I've got a group of three friends and I. We're going to go out and do some duck hunting and hopefully get some mallards. And I would love to have my favorite mallard dish, which is pan-seared, dry-aged mallard. as good as any filet mignon you've ever had.
How do you do that? Can you walk our listeners through that process?
Well, step one is to get a duck. Yeah, step one, get a duck. Hunting is my preferred way, but you could purchase ducks as well. Tame ducks are a little different than wild ducks. But then I like to pluck the bird and then remove the breast with the skin on and dry age it in the refrigerator for 5 to 7 days. Kind of reduces some of the moisture content, concentrates the flavors. And then I'll cross-hatch the skin and then pan sear it for about 3 minutes on the skin side and about 2 minutes on the non-skin side to about a rare to almost medium rare, but you don't want to get past medium rare. Then I'll make a little reduction sauce with some Grand Marnier, maybe some shallots, and reduce that down. Slice the duck breast thinly, put that sauce
over it.
You're
starting to get a very dreamy look.
I know,
in your
eyes. Just thinking about it. It's a week from now, it'll be a memory. But that's my favorite way to cook mallard, is dry aged, pan seared, but don't overcook it. That's the key.
In just a minute, our food critics will be here to tell us about their favorite places to get turkey and quail and pheasant and duck on local menus. But before you and I say goodbye, I'd really like to hear your recommendations, too. Can you start with the dish that you like at a fair in the Crossroads?
Okay. So Martin Huser at a fair, during special events, makes a really fun quail lollipop. With the quail legs, and I believe it's wrapped in either prosciutto or really thin bacon and grilled. But he also makes a really amazing pheasant dish there that's pretty tasty. I actually just saw Chef Martin yesterday, and I'm taking him on a duck hunt in December. So Chef Martin does some really fun stuff with wild game, ducks and geese. But my favorite duck dish is the duck dish at Waldo Tie.
Tell us about it.
Oh, my gosh. Similar to what they did in Brookside Poultry, they brine it and then roast it and then fry it crispy. But this is served in a Penang curry sauce, a little peanut curry sauce. The skin is crispy. The meat is just, it's legs and thighs only, not the breast. But it is just stellar.
And do you like a duck carnitas?
Yes. Chef Carlos at Jarocho will make duck carnitas on occasion. And put that in a warm tortilla with some fresh pico de gallo, a little avocado, and it's pretty tasty stuff.
James Worley, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
We will have lots of delicious-sounding recommendations for the birds of the season with the food critics when we come back from our break. And we'd love to hear from you, too, 816-235-2888. But do it fast, because we'll be switching gears to talk restaurant news after that. 816-235-2888. Call now. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. We're back with the food critics on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Jenny Vergara, Mary Block, and Liz Cook. Jenny is with us from Feast Magazine. Hi, Jenny.
Good morning.
And Liz joins us from The Pitch. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning, Gina.
Mary is a food blogger. She's been doing these shows for a long, long time. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
So we're talking about how birds are featured on area menus today. Quail, pheasant, turkey, but mostly as I look at your lists, we are mostly talking duck. Is duck just the main thing chefs tend to work with?
It feels that way. We were talking about how pheasant and quail and squab should all be on this list.
Squab is?
Pigeon.
Yeah, I just learned this.
Yeah. But duck seems to be more favored. Maybe it's a little bit easier to sell.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it has more to do with what the market demands than what the chefs are really willing to work with and can get their hands on.
All right, well, call 816-235-2888 if you have recommendations for what we are today calling the fowl less eaten. We will get back to duck, but I do want to start with some of the other things people might be less likely to have tried before in case they want some ideas for where to start. Liz, talk to me about the quail they serve at campground.
Yeah, so this has been on the menu for a while, and they have what's called a brick quail. So what that means is essentially they're taking a brick and they're weighing down these quail legs on the grill. So you get kind of maximum contact between the skin of the quail and the grill. Great surface area, great browning.
Is this like a quail preparation tradition? Like, I've never heard of brick anything before.
So it's used for a lot of different
really?
Birds.
Really? Okay. Yeah. I'm just learning. I'm still learning, guys.
Yeah, so you get the crisp skin, because that's honestly the best part of any kind of like fowl dish, right?
Here.
You want to eat that crisp skin like a potato chip. But the quail there, they have a few different quail leg quarters. And I don't know, a lot of people who aren't hunters might not know what the size of a quail is. So I'm just going to say this. They are very cute.
Aww,
it is
teeny weeny.
They're teeny little legs. So you get like, there's probably three quails that went into this dish if you order the dinner sized version. But the meat is still really tender. It's like dark meat chicken kind of. Mm-hmm. And you get that kind of dark supple meat, and they serve it with a really bright root vegetable puree at campground.
Mm, okay. And that's in the West Bottoms, right?
That is, yes.
A fairly new place.
Yeah, no, they also do really great cocktails, too. It started as a cocktail bar, but they've got a really interesting food menu now as well.
Well, so Jenny, they have what I believe is kind of a fried quail dish at Vietnam Cafe, kind of a street food type thing.
Yeah, you know, my feeling about quail in general is kind of, I kind of wonder if the juice is worth the squeeze on it, just because it is so teeny weeny. And this is definitely, when you deal with quail, can I just tell you to please put your fork and knife down? It's just not worth it to try to, you know, pick apart delicately. This is really something where you just need to kind of twist and pull a leg and kind of go for it. It's one of those. And it certainly is the case at Vietnam Cafe.
They get in touch with your caveman roots.
Yeah, you kind of have to. We have big bulky fingers and these are teeny tiny birds. And so there's just, you know, just don't waste any of it. Just go ahead and go for it. But yeah, at Vietnam Cafe, they have fried quail is a pretty traditional kind of street food. My understanding is there's lots of street food vendors in Vietnam that just kind of cook these birds really crispy, stack them up. And then when you order them, they flash fry them real quick again to kind of heat them back up and then quarter them, kind of chop them up for you and serve them on a platter. And that's pretty much what you're getting here at Vietnam Cafe. I think it's served on a bed of lettuce with a little bit of pickles, kind of some carrots and maybe some celery or something else on there that's kind of pickled, maybe some onions.
This is the restaurant in Columbus Park, right?
Yes, this is the location in Columbus Park. So it's delicious. If you're a crispy quail person, it's just a great, easy way to go and get that.
Has anyone had a delicious pheasant dish on a local menu, or is that more the kind of thing that hunters tend to prepare for a feast for family and friends?
I
see no pheasant.
Yeah, I think it's more of a hunter's dish, but I know that, you know, some of the chefs in town are hunters, and you will occasionally see it on the menu. A fair is a place that would normally have pheasant. Chef Martin is kind of a big hunter, so you'd have to kind of look for those kinds of places. But, I don't know that the public is really going in and demanding pheasant either, so I think it's a two-way street.
More of like you might see it as a special.
Yeah.
On a seasonal basis.
Sure.
Okay. Well, the rest of our recommendations in studio are for duck and a little bit of turkey. They sound amazing, but if you out there know of a really nice place for pheasant or quail or goose.
Emu. Ostrich.
Ostrich had not made my list, but go ahead. Like, I want to know. 816-235-2888. And time is running out, folks. So now, do it now. Okay. Duck. Mary, tell me about the whole duck at Antler Room.
This is a spectacular dish. Nick Gellner, who is the chef owner, has it on the menu, I urge you to get it. It's a large format. It serves 3 to 6 people, depending on how hungry you are. It's an Aylesbury duck breast that it has been cut for you, but it's put back together. So it's a beautiful presentation. And it comes with a flatbread that's kind of like a naan, so it's very soft, with some fermented honey and some scallions and sprouts and salt, and you just make your own taco, essentially.
I know that this is not the point, but can you tell me a little more about fermented honey, because you got my attention there.
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know how to make it, but it just has a little bit of a stronger flavor. There's more to it.
Yeah. I was going to say, fermented honey, isn't that how you get mead?
Yeah, that's why it's stronger, I guess. But this is just a fabulous dish. And it's these birds are hard to come by, so it's not often on the menu. But that's one of those must-eat dishes.
So there's also, Mary, a dish at Blue Koi called Firebird that you can get with your choice of protein, but you recommend it specifically with duck.
I do. You can get chicken or tofu, but the duck just has more flavor. And I'm a dark meat eater anyway. I prefer dark chicken. And so the duck just calls to me. It's boneless, so you don't have to worry about, you know, getting at the duck. And it's got a lot of hot chili peppers and scallions. It's not for the faint of heart, but you put it on rice and to cut the heat. It's delicious.
And Jenny, I am intrigued by the cured duck leg on your list. That's at Freshwater?
Yeah, Freshwater is such a cute little place. It's next to kind of Southwest Traffic Way. And they really have developed a reputation for themselves for their vegetable items, although they do have a duck entree on their menu right now. And it's really good. It's got spicy tasso ham that they basically confit a duck leg in. So it's the fat from the ham kind of, and the duck, I'm sure there's some duck fat in there as well. And they serve it over popcorn grits, a roasted turnip, and a little duck jus on top. And it's just a beautiful duck leg. It's a really interesting presentation. They're really hyper-focused on local ingredients. So it's really, really local duck that's used. Yeah, I just think it's a fun presentation. Duck leg.
And then a smoked duck salad at Le Fou Frog.
Yeah, I mean, of course they're going to have a duck salad. This is a lovely chilled duck salad that has a kind of a sliced breast. Basically, it's got this kind of peppery arugula and then these sweet counterpoints. It's got some apple slices and then a raspberry vinaigrette over the top of it that just kind of makes it sweet and tart and peppery and then this luscious, unctuous duck sliced on top.
Okay, that sounds really good. Liz, talk to me about the red curry duck at Lemongrass Thai.
Yeah, so red curry is kind of a standard order at a lot of Americanized Thai restaurants. And I think like the chicken that it's usually served with isn't bringing a lot to the party because the red curry is so strong, it just can't hold up to it. But what Lemongrass does is they do a red curry duck, and that meat is so fatty and rich that it's got something that can stand up to the really bright, snappy red curry. And you have like a little squeeze of sliced orange off the top. So you just have a little bit of acid and sweetness to kind of cut through the rich flavors. And I think it's a great dish.
I will agree that chicken often does not bring enough to the party in a really like flavorful, spicy dish.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about like how our lists are full of duck. Well, this is a cow town, right? And as kind of James alluded to earlier, duck is really a red meat. It's got all those red muscle fibers. So it kind of appeals to our desire for a fattier, more flavorful meat, I think.
Okay, we're going to get right back to our critics' recommendations, but I have to take this call from Amanda calling us from Platte Woods about pheasant. Hi, Amanda.
Good morning.
What do you have to share with us?
Well, I am actually from southwestern Kansas. We lived in a little town called Leota for about 4 years. And we were way out. This is way out by Colorado. And we went to this tiny little church on the that bordered about three or four different counties. And a bunch of the women were talking one year, the Sunday before Thanksgiving, about how they just did not feel like cooking a big meal that year. So we all decided to get together at the church, and everybody would bring something. And the men all went out pheasant hunting. And it just kind of became a tradition from there where we had pheasant on Thanksgiving at the church.
So what do you have to share about how to prepare and enjoy pheasant as one of the many fowl less eaten?
That I have no idea. I defer to my elders on that because I was only in college at the time.
Well,
I just remember how delicious it was.
It sounds like a really lovely tradition. Thanks for calling and telling us about it, Amanda.
Yeah.
Thanks for that call. Okay, so we're going to get back to duck on Kansas City menus. And Liz, you were just telling us about the red curry duck at Lemongrass Thai. There's also a dish you like at Room 39.
Yeah, so Room 39, they have a couple locations, but the original one is in the 39 West neighborhood, and it's this very cute, small, romantic bistro, and they really focus on seasonal ingredients, so the menu rotates all the time. But one of a couple constants is they almost always have some iteration of a smoked duck breast on the menu. And so smoking that really suffuses what's already a pretty dark, dewy meat with a lot of extra flavor, and it's perfect for this time of year. So right now, that breast comes with Swiss chard and some curried cauliflower and a nice butternut squash puree. So it's just a really lovely autumnal dish that feels perfect for November.
It does sound very fall. Jenny, you have got duck empanadas on your list and duck ravioli, and I want to hear about both of those.
Yeah, duck inside a pastry form of one ilk or the other.
Yes.
Story has always had the duck empanadas on their menu as long as I can remember, like maybe since the first day they opened in the Prairie Village shops. And Chef Carl basically takes smoked duck and puts a Latin spin on it. He just basically has it with black beans, avocado, jicama. It's topped with a little barbecue sauce. And it's just a couple of bites. They're not very big. But it's just a lovely way to kind of treat, again, this really rich, lovely dark meat that brings a lot of flavor to the table in it. And it really does stand up up to kind of all of the Mexican spices that are kind of in this dish. And then the other dish is at JJ's. And it's
the ravioli.
The ravioli, indeed. So, I've kind of got one of everything, like an appetizer, entree, pasta dish. I've got a salad.
Yeah, you could have a whole, like, duck party.
I have created
the duck dinner.
The perfect duck meal I have created. But, so at JJ's, the pasta basically has house-made duck raviolis. It's got duck confit, so it's really, cooked in its own fat, pulled apart, and it's got warm veal butter sauce that they pour over the top of it, which is crazy rich. Like, get this and a salad with a little bit of, touch of vinaigrette dressing just to cut, or a little acid to cut the richness of this dish. But it's pasta with confit duck, and then it has this veal butter sauce over the top. It's really rich, but very delicious.
It sounds like, you eat this like this is like a meal of a lifetime kind of thing. This is like you set aside the night, like this night is dedicated to this meal kind of meal.
And then you go home and call your cardiologist. Make your appointment for the next day.
And so then a duckling at Avalon Cafe, that's in Weston, right?
Right. I had to kind of put this on the menu because this is another dish. Some of these duck dishes have just like stood the test of time, and this is certainly one of them. I think it's always been on the menu at Avalon. And it's really simple. It's a lovely duck, and it's kind of got this, they call it a duckling on the menu, but it's got basically lingonberry and Chambord sauce poured over the top. So this really sweet kind of fruity, tangy kind of sauce over the top that brings out everything. It just looks like this dark, luscious glaze that's over the top of this duck. So really, really delicious.
Mary, you seem to be a pretty big fan of the Fox and Pearls take on duck. Can you tell us about that?
Gladly.
Spare no detail.
Okay. Well, Chef Vaughn Good really likes his duck because you can get it in three different preparations on the menu at any given time.
Yeah, tell us about all of them.
So my favorite of the moment is his appetizer duck pate, and it's so cute. It comes in a little mason jar, and it's like a parfait. You've got the duck pate on the bottom and then a jam on the top. In the summer, it was strawberry. I think right now it might be peach.
I want to just say this is the second time we've heard the word cute in our discussion waterfowl. So just
put
throwing
it out
that
there.
Out there. Okay, yeah, go on.
The preparation is cute. And then he takes Fervere bread, which I love just by itself, but it's grilled. So it's got a lot of, it takes on a new dimension. And then you just spread the pate, put a little sweet jam on top, and it's the perfect bite. And then if you move on to the entrees, he has a smoked duck breast that's been grilled, and then it sits on a silky celery root puree. And that's just a lovely winter dish. And then speaking of lovely winter dishes, the ultimate comfort food is a cassoulet. And they have one where they take the duck leg confit. And
what is a cassoulet in case
it's a French dish, and it's casserole.
That's
basically
kind of what I thought, but I didn't want to be the one to say it.
But it's cooked up with white beans and sausage and duck.
Sort of a French casserole.
Very much so. And it is the ultimate comfort food.
It'll stick to your ribs.
Yeah, it does.
So this duck cassoulet that they have at Fox and Pearl, you like it a lot?
I do.
Okay, so Mary recommends duck three ways at Fox and Pearl. And Mary, there is a perennial favorite on your list. I knew to expect it, but I want to give you the chance to say why this lives, no matter what happens in Kansas City restaurants, this is a favorite dish of yours, the duck at Princess Garden.
It is indeed. I'm so glad you asked me about it. Princess Garden has been on the scene for almost four decades, and I think I've been going for most of that time. The family
it's
always
on Warnell.
On Warnell, yes. It used to be owned by, the patriarch has now passed it down to his sons, Sammy and Robert, who are well known to all patrons. And it used to be that the father would come out and present this beautiful whole duck, and then he would carve it at the table and present it with scallions, a thin Chinese pancake, a spoonful of hoisin sauce. And then you make a little sandwich, and it's very celebratory. And now that tradition has been passed down to Sammy and Robert. One of them always comes out. And
so it feels like a real family experience.
It is a real family experience. If you go with a big group, you've got to get it, but you need to order it ahead of time. And it's as close to a trip to Beijing as you're going to get here in Kansas City.
Well, so guys, before we switch gears, Thanksgiving is on the way. That's the whole inspiration for this show. So we need to talk turkey. Mary, for a turkey or duck to cook at home, you go to?
Broadway Butcher Shop. I think you can still order, but do it today. They have wonderful turkey there. If you want to cook your own duck, they've got duck on hand, often in the freezer as well, different pieces and whatnot.
And Jenny and Liz, you are both telling us about places where you can take a turkey and have it prepared for you. I love this idea. Liz, Niecy's?
Yeah, so this time of year tends to bring out a few cranks that are like, oh, actually, turkey is terrible because it's so dry and stringy, because they had like an Aunt Rhoda who bought a 20-pound turkey and like cooked it for 6 hours until it tasted like corn silk. But what you can do to kind of convert these turkey haters is get a deep-fried turkey. And you really want to get that done for you, because
yes.
It is a production.
Do not try this at home.
You've got to do it outside in like a giant pot the size of Abraham Lincoln's stovepipe hat that you can never use for anything.
Just go to YouTube. Just Google fried turkey disaster.
The fire department will
that
love
too.
You if
also
you
a fire
get it taken
hazard.
Care of.
So go to Niecy's. They will do it for you. You can bring your own turkey. There's a BYOT operation there, and they'll fry it for you for like $2.75 a pound, or they can supply the whole bird for you. You can have it either way. And this is going to convert turkey skeptics for a couple of reasons. One, when you deep fry a turkey, it cooks in like half an hour. Mm-hmm. So there's really no time to dry out the meat. And it gives you that really crisp skin. We were talking earlier about how much we love crisp skin. When you roast a turkey, the skin can kind of be a little bit leathery, but when you fry it, you get that perfectly shatteringly crisp skin that you want. So highly recommend the fried turkey at Niecy's. You don't have to clean up afterward.
Yeah, Amen. That is another selling point. Jenny, you have, you're sharing something that can be done with your turkey at Fritz's.
Yeah, Fritz's Smokehouse. So this is a smoked turkey. For $2 a pound, you can bring in your own bird, whatever size is going to feed your family. And I think you bring it in on a Wednesday. They smoke them on Thursdays, and you can pick them up either Friday or Saturday. The schedule changes just a little bit for the holidays, so you should definitely go online and definitely plan to get your bird in ASAP. But a good old smoked turkey adds an awful lot of flavor to, again, the complaint of turkey tastes like nothing.
Well, we're going to leave our conversation about waterfowl right there, but our list of the best birds on local menus will include a few recommendations that did not make it into this conversation, so definitely check it out at kcur.org over the weekend. I'm Gina Kaufman. When the food critics return, they will have the biggest restaurant news of the season. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, once a season, our food critics do a special edition where they take a minute to look at the season's worth of news. And then they let us know about the new places that they believe are real game changers here in town, as well as the closings that have left people feeling quite stunned. And in fact, I'm going to do something kind of unusual this time around. I do want to start with the bad news. And I'm sorry, but there has been a lot of it, and it has been kind of major. So Liz Cook of The Pitch, you wrote about the closing of Crockstrom Club and Market. We knew they'd been struggling. That had been not hidden from the public. So it wasn't so much a surprise as, well, you called it a referendum on dining culture in Kansas City.
Yeah, so we've been in kind of a restaurant boom for a few years. We've had kind of a record number of openings every year. And at some point, we've all kind of sensed that the other shoe was going to drop because you know, our population hasn't exploded in the same way that the number of options that we have has. And Crockstrom was always kind of a tough sell. It was a critical darling. I loved it. It earned, I think, Feast's Best Restaurant of the Year. It was featured on an episode of Guy Fieri's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives in September.
Hard to argue that was a dive, but go on.
Right, exactly. But so it got all of this critical attention, but they just couldn't generate the traffic that they needed to stay open.
So when you say they were a critical darling, for people who may be sort of new to Kansas City dining culture, based on what? What was it that was so wonderful about it from the critical standpoint?
So they were doing something that was totally new. It was a really fresh vision, and it was also delicious. So it's not often that you get both of those in the same package. A talented chef who's really executing a clear, defined vision with a focused menu. I think I've kind of struggled a while with our restaurant scene locally because there's this feeling of kind of sameness with a lot of the dishes that we see. Like I kind of mentioned this in the piece I wrote, but you know, there's 500 restaurants where you can get like an $18 short rib mac and cheese. It's a little harder to find a Flying Jacob, which is one of the dishes that Katie did, which had this confit chicken quarter in a peanut sauce with chili nuts and bananas and was like a really Scandinavian kind of stoner food.
Yeah, so when you say this is a referendum on dining culture, in what sense?
So I think the fact that we're able to sustain a lot of what I called these like samey restaurants, but we're not willing to take a chance on something that's maybe a little unfamiliar or doing something a little different, that's concerning to me. I take that as kind of a, like, a little bit of a warning. So is this a place where chefs feel like they can take creative risks and where they can thrive? That's something I worry about a lot.
Okay. Anyone else want to chime in on that?
I think Liz said it all.
So we see some agreement in the room on that one. Mary Block, you wanted to talk about the news that Black Dirt is closing.
Yes.
And so, I'd like to point out that Jonathan Justice's previous restaurant, Justice Drugstore, closed quite silently in the wake of this restaurant opening on the plaza.
It did. He had a plan to reopen it once he got Black Dirt settled, but it never did, and then he ended up selling the space. But people really loved Jonathan's food, Jonathan Justice, but he just couldn't make it. And it goes a little bit to Liz's point, is some of the dishes on there maybe were not same enough. You know, they were a little different, and people had trouble wrapping their arms around some of it. And so he is closing, which is really too bad. I understand another chef-driven restaurant is going to take its place, which I was really happy to hear about. I was hoping it wasn't going to be a chain. So that is good news.
Do you see some sort of like larger absence on the restaurant scene without either Justice Drugstore or Black Dirt? Is there some type of cuisine, some hole that's left?
Well, he was always super local, nose to tail, didn't waste anything. And I think all chefs try to do that, but he specialized in it.
Jenny, some restaurant chains based here have declared bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and don't worry, we will get to the good news.
there is some rainbow at the end of this. But yeah, just recently in the last week or so, we've had kind of two restaurant groups here in Kansas City that declared bankruptcy. Bread and Butter Concepts was one. They own Stock Hill, Urban Table, the recently closed Oliver. What am I missing?
Graham and Dunn.
Thank you, Graham and Dunn. And then also the Houlihan's chain.
Big names, popular places.
Right. And then the chain that owns Houlihan's, it's a restaurant group that basically had the Bristol's and Jay Gilbert's as well, I believe, was on there. And they actually were snapped up by Landry as soon as they announced their bankruptcy. They announced in the morning, and by the afternoon, the news feed was basically saying that Landry Company had bought Houlihan's out. So,
is there a big takeaway from this?
You know, I think it's one of those things where if you aren't distinguishing yourself from the pack, you're just going to be a losing proposition. You know, we have this really interesting juxtaposition where chefs who are trying something unique can't make it because they are so strange. But yet, if you are just one of many giving the same experience and similar food, you're really not setting yourself apart either.
Can I share? I mean, it's not my place to have a theory, but I do wonder about whether the art of redefinition or sort of putting yourself back out there again and again as something new is an important part. I wonder if that's an important part of longevity in our current restaurant market. You know what I mean? So if just the life cycle of what's the new exciting place, you have to kind of get yourself back into that life cycle somehow.
Well, and we certainly have had that in Kansas City with what we discussed earlier, which was the growth. And I do want to step back and just talk for a second about Bread and Butter Concepts. He is coming out of bankruptcy. I mean, he has filed bankruptcy. This is a course correction for him. The way he, this is Alan Galen, who is the CEO of Bread and Butter. And all his locations are open and going for business, you know, still open for business, still moving forward. So he just sees this basically as kind of a financial course correction for his overall health of his company, and he continues to thrive. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen, obviously, with Landry taking over kind of the rest of the Houlihan's. But yeah, that was some pretty big news that kind of shook a lot of local restaurant chains and franchisees, frankly, in Kansas City.
Well, Gina, I think you hit on something really interesting there when you talked about kind of how we're always chasing something new. I think that's something that I worry about a lot as well. I mean, not to pin too much on like Instagram, but I think we're all very much like chasing a new experience that we can document. moment, mm-hmm. and it's less flashy to go back to a place and take a third picture of the same entree and post it. You're not going to get the same attention.
If everyone's talking about something, you want to know what it's about, so you race there. And if you aren't going out to dinner every night.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and you have to remember that what we do here on this panel every day is not the typical experience of the consumer that's out in the world. Most people, it takes them 7 or 8 times before they're like, oh, yeah, I need to try. I keep hearing about that place. Mm-hmm. Like, it takes a while for things to sink in. So our job is basically to kind of chase the next thing and hopefully write about it. It is difficult to get back to good places, even as a food writer in this town. So,
okay, so super quick, one last piece of bad news, you guys, and we're going to deal with this quickly, but the story of Broadway Deli closing. This, in my mind, is sort of a national story on some level, that the old school deli is something people have been trying hard to revive, redefine, but also hang on to as this nostalgic thing. Everyone wants one of these in their city, but maybe is it not how we actually eat anymore?
I don't know.
No.
I think there are plenty of really well-done delis all over the country that are killing it. And one of them in D.C. just got Restaurant of the Year, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think it was more about the execution than the style.
Any thoughts on this?
And the location.
Yeah. So the owners blamed, I think, parking. That was one of the things that they cited. It's at a Broadway space where there wasn't a lot of street parking. I don't know to what extent that really mattered for diners. But it was also on the higher end price-wise. And we see delis like M&M Bakery, for example. It's been an institution in the city for a long time that seems to be really thriving as a deli. So I'm disappointed that we couldn't have a mostly Jewish deli, as they kind of had their tagline, mm-hmm. Survive. And there's still not a fantastic place to get pastrami in the city. That's a hole I'm hoping someone will fill.
Yes.
But we do have some delis. So I think, like, I'm not sure I'm willing to say that, like, we can't sustain deli culture.
No, it's not a deli thing. And we can have a good Jewish deli. It's just got to be put in the right location in the city, I think.
And M&M's origins is actually as a Jewish deli.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, so the good news. That all being said, there are plenty of new places you are all excited to talk about. Pirate's Bone is on everyone's list. Start us off, Jenny.
Oh, so Pirate's Bone is basically this lovely kind of vegan, inclusive, colorful, lovely experience. It's right on the streetcar line on Main. And basically, they're serving little tiny kind of sliders that have these gorgeous black charcoal buns with different kind of vegan or vegetarian fillings. They even have a bit of their own kind of impossible burger for anybody wanting kind of more of the meat experience and less of the veg. But they're fun.
The meat-esque experience.
That's right. They've got fries that go with. And I just think, you know, it's just one of those places to pop into. It's an easy place to stop for lunch or dinner. You walk out of there feeling like $1 million because you haven't had a big greasy burger, but you've had that kind of, it scratches that itch, if you know what I mean. And it's a fun place. It's a counter experience. You sit at this beautiful turquoise counter and kind of chat with people around you. And it's very social. And I love it. I think Pirate's Bone's great.
Anyone else want to add anything about Pirate's Bone, a favorite thing to get there?
You know, there are plenty of restaurants around town where you can get a black bean burger or some other kind of veggie burger, but I like their beet burger, B-E-E-T, purple and bright and pretty and delicious.
Mm-hmm. I will just add that I am a big fan of vegan junk food, and I think a lot of times, like, vegan restaurants will brand themselves as, like, very earth mother or mm-hmm. like juice and kale. And so I love just having a place for comfort food. Like, you can get poutine here. Yeah. You can get vegan poutine. I think that's filling a hole
in our dining. The gravy
and
fries and I guess not cheese curds, but curds
maybe
of
like
some
curd
kind.
With a K. Yeah.
So then also on everyone's list is Sayachi Sushi and Oysters. Mary, start us off on this one.
So Sayachi is owned by Chef Carlos Falcone, who owns Jarocho's in KCPK and also in Leawood. And he recently took over the old Domo spot in Brookside. What I think makes his sushi restaurant unique is he offers an omakase option, which is Japanese for let the chef serve you what he wants. And you sit at the sushi counter and you just get small plate after small plate, lots of different beautiful fish come to you and you don't know what you're going to get. And I think that's really a fun option. I think he's only doing it a couple nights a week at this point, but you can still go and get pristine, beautiful sashimi and nigiri and rolls.
I did say all of you recommended this place. So what made it stand out so much that with three people who focus so intently on the food scene in Kansas City, all three of you see this as like a game changer?
Well, I think it's the talent in the kitchen. So I think Mary's already spoken to Chef Carlos Falcone, and he knows seafood. Like, Jarocho is very focused on, like, Veracruzian-style Mexican food and very seafood-heavy. So I think when we all saw that he was opening a restaurant that where he was making that focus even more directly on, like, fresh, raw fish, that's got to be exciting.
Same. And he went into Domo Sushi's location, so it was already a location that was known for sushi. So it just seemed like the match made in heaven. I mean, here comes a brand new sushi place in a place that already had a sushi place by the guy in town who can source any fish he wants at any point and serve it in a beautiful sashimi style. I mean, omakase that he has been doing at Jarocho is basically a Japanese term for kind of, you know, habit chef's way. And so to have it finally, omakase finally exist within the Japanese context at Sayachi, I think, is brilliant. You know, the thing we've all been waiting and hoping for. So,
and they also have a nice bar scene, which is not altogether typical at a sushi restaurant.
Yeah. I also wonder, would I be out of turn in suggesting that maybe this is big news also for Brookside as far as a dining destination?
Because it's not a chain.
Yeah. I mean, I think Brookside absolutely would support sushi. I mean, they had for years and years when Domo was there. So I think they're probably tickled pink.
Well, so Liz, you are excited about a new Vietnamese place. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I'm really enjoying Lynn's Vietnamese cuisine right now, and that is in this kind of small, unassuming restaurant in this strip mall at the corner of Independence Ave and the Paseo. And we've seen a few different Vietnamese restaurants kind of cycle through that same location over the years, and this one feels a little bit different. They've got an expanded menu. They make a great banh mi with they bake the baguettes every day fresh in-house, and they're the perfect combination of crunchy and soft. They're not going to give you TMJ.
That's right.
Which is a
That's
problem
right.
for a lot of... But the rice noodle salads, I think, are the main draw here. They've got a really expanded menu, including a vermicelli salad with barbecue pork, slices of fried egg rolls, and these like really bright pickled vegetables to add a fresh acidic contrast to all of that fried richness. So I highly recommend checking them out for something different than you can find everywhere else.
And, you know, Mary, there is some place on your list that I think a lot of people who were fans of McCoy's are probably curious about if they have not already tried it. And that is the place that's gone into the old McCoy's space, Mickey's Hideaway.
Exactly. McCoy's was there for, it felt like forever. And so it's nice that it has been reincarnated. It's still owned by the same people who own McCoy's and also Beer Kitchen and Char Bar. It's a huge menu. You've got a lot of burgers, sandwiches, and salads, but it also has some fun items like a crispy pork hash, short rib bolognese. They do a Detroit-style pizza, burnt-end nachos. They do a weekly lobster roll special. And it's a nice redo. It's a nice renovation as well.
Jenny, I need to hear about the Iron District.
Yeah, you know, the Iron District... basically, in North Kansas City, it's the first container park kind of food hall that we've seen. It's an outdoor concept, so their days are probably numbered in terms of just weather-wise what they'll be able to execute. I think they're planning to probably stay open. They do have some retail stores mixed in with the restaurants that are going to decide to maybe weather the winter, so you can certainly go and shop there. But I think for the food piece of this, your days are numbered, so you need to get out and get it. But there's about seven places that have opened up inside of there. There's an avocado place. There's a gluten-free bakery.
Wait, an avocado place.
Yeah, it's called Avo Bite, and it's a new restaurateur who's, this is kind of her first rattle out of the box, and this is really built for new restaurateurs who are kind of trying concepts, I would tell you. Just, you know, maybe not ready for full-on brick and mortar or full-on operations, but just like a...
But ready for a container.
Ready to for a stand-up window. Here's your food. Thank you for coming.
It's like latest iteration of a food truck park.
Yeah. Basically. But she's doing kind of everything in an avocado. So, you know, it's got some meat, some veg, but avocado plays a role in every single dish. And she kind of changes it up quite a bit. There's a tiki bar inside of this place called Tiki Huna, which is really good. You've got Plantain District, which is Rachel, who owns basically Iron District, and she's got her Cuban sandwich there. So a lot of different places to try. Kind Food is doing vegan for vegan folks. So
Jenny, as you
can
hear, we are racing out. But can you, you have a very long list, and I just want you to have a chance to throw out one more thing of your choosing.
Peros Estetorio. It's the new Greek place that has opened up inside of the former Room 39 location out south. It is a stunning revamp of this dining room that I don't know it ever really found its footing. It has found a new home. It's beautiful Greek food, incredible menu. I cannot recommend it enough. I am just blown away by the food that's coming out of this kitchen.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there. Our time is up. Jenny Vergara of Feast Magazine, thank you so much.
Of course, thank you.
Mary Block, thank you.
You bet.
And Liz Cook, it has been great having you today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You can read Liz's reviews in The Pitch, and that's a wrap. We'll have lists galore for your personal reference. You can get them online over the weekend at kcur.org, or if you follow the station on Twitter or Facebook, those lists will appear automatically in your feed. We'll be back next week with a bunch of new shows, and we've been working hard behind the scenes throughout the impeachment hearings on stuff that we're really excited for you to hear. So be sure and tune in weekdays 10 to 11, and talk to us on Twitter over the weekend at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, Noah Taborda, and Sylvia Maria Gross. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.